In 1986, James McGill Buchanan was awarded the Alfred Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. He was recognized for his work in developing a theoretical framework that extends the tools of economic analysis into examining how political decisions are made. This work has come to be known as the Public Choice School of Economic Theory. Public choice theory, as pioneered by James Buchanan, provides a deeper understanding of how government policy is affected by the self-interest of politicians and other political and economic forces. In a way, his interest in both economics and political science are quite fitting. The son of Scotch-Irish parents, James Buchanan grew up on a large farm in a rural and agricultural area of Tennessee, very near the site of a pivotal conflict in the American Civil War, the Battle of Stones River. Although poor, his family had considerable status in their small community, largely because his grandfather had served as governor of the state of Tennessee. The family expected that young James would follow his grandfather's example.
I was groomed to be a lawyer. In a sense, I was groomed first to be a politician, to follow in my grandfather's footsteps.
But the Depression altered those plans, as Vanderbilt University became too expensive for a family of limited means. Instead, Buchanan attended Middle Tennessee State Teachers College, largely because it was nearby and allowed him to live at home, where he could earn money for fees and books by milking dairy cows. Buchanan wasted no time in distinguishing himself as one of the finest students at the college, and after receiving his bachelor's degree in 1940, he was given a scholarship to the University of Tennessee for a year of graduate study in economics. He received a Master of Sciences degree in 1941. Plans to continue his graduate training at Columbia University were cut short by the prospects of the military draft. In August of 1941, Buchanan volunteered for service in the U.S. Navy and served 4 years at Pacific Fleet headquarters in Pearl Harbor and Guam. In 1945, he faced what he later called his only real career choice, whether to stay in the military, as he was urged by his superiors, or leave it for further academic training. Intrigued by the exciting intellectual climate he had heard about at the University of Chicago, Buchanan left what had been a very satisfying service in the military and embarked for his PhD studies in economics in the Midwest. While at the University of Chicago, he met Frank Knight, the famed economist, who was to be his greatest teacher and mentor. In Knight's price theory class, Buchanan was converted from his early belief in populist and socialist ideas. He became, as he later called it, a zealous advocate of the market order. Since then, James Buchanan has devoted his life to studying the fundamental structures of political and economic decision-making. Through such works as his classic The Calculus of Consent, written in collaboration with Gordon Tullock, to The Limits of Liberty, published in 1975, to The Power to Tax and The Reason of Rules, both written with Jeffrey Brennan, Buchanan has continued his push for new ways to approach these abiding questions. Liberty Fund invited Professor Buchanan to a conversation about his life and work with Jeffrey Brennan, his longtime associate, co-author, and close friend. Jeff Brennan is professor of economics at the Australian National University. In part one of this conversation, Buchanan discussed the theory of public choice, his exchange theory of economics, and constitutional thought. In this program, which is part two of the conversation, Buchanan turns to such topics as the work ethic, the logic of free markets, subjectivism, anarchy, federalism, the Nobel Prize in Economics, and Buchanan's personal experiences and philosophy. We welcome you to a conversation with Professor James Buchanan.
Let's talk about the work ethic.
Okay.
You have unusual work habits yourself, I would say. I mean, a typical day, well, you correct me, sort of may, it may be a bit different now, but when I was in the Public Choice Centre with you, you would go in about 6 in the morning and you'd work till about 5:30 in the afternoon. And you'd do that on Saturdays and you'd work at least half a day on Sundays. And you've done that for most of your career. And that was catching, actually. I mean, other people in the centre reflected that. And in recent past, you've tried to give an articulation of both of your own attitude on this and of how one might ground that normatively, make a general argument in favour of the work ethic.
As far as the more recent type of stuff on the work ethic, I became convinced that somehow or another, if I work harder, that has to provide a benefit for in general. That is, we're in a better world where people work hard. But now you go back to your neoclassical models. The idealized, competitive, stylized models.
Right.
You can't generate that result. Right. I felt there was more to it than that. So maybe there was something wrong with basic economic theory. And this is one thing I think, go back to our earlier points about Frank Knight. One thing you learn from Frank Knight is you accept no authority.
Right.
Absolutely no authority. That's what you learn from him. You can tackle anything.
Right.
And there's nothing sacred about received economic theory or anything else, and right. So maybe something was wrong with it, and so then I had to go back to these models that I had always rejected, just based on teaching of Frank Knight and others. Always accepted the neoclassical paradigm,
sure.
And have to go back and throw out the constant returns models.
Right,
and you introduce the increasing returns model, the work ethic stuff falls out. Very easily. If you, so I go back and trace out the people who have been dissidents from the mainline tradition in economics, going back to Alan Young's, well, Adam Smith a little bit, Marshall a little bit, but then, well, Adam Smith's whole thing about the division of labor depends on the extent of the market.
Yes.
And division of labor is what drives productivity, so the bigger the market, the more specialization, the more you can get. So it's an increasing returns model. Marshall picked it up a little in the external economy stuff. And then Alan Young wrote this very confusing piece, but a very seminal piece, Increasing Returns and Economic Progress in 1928. And Kaldor and a few others were dissenting all along from the neoclassical paradigm on these grounds. And so there was a sort of a dissident strand.
Right.
And picking that up and saying, well, for the whole economy, the bigger the economy, the more division of labor, the more specialization. So therefore, you can get a bigger bang for the buck, so to speak, bigger output for input. Then you come right back down to it. If you work an extra hour, that the economy is bigger.
Right.
The whole economy is bigger. So there's some specialization out there that can be picked up. It could not have been picked up before. But what's interesting about that, think of it that way, and think of it in terms strictly of the Adam Smith model, division of labor, extended market. That gives you, and I used it, and I came at it from a point of view of trying to argue that there is economic content in the work ethic.
Right.
But you can look at it from the point of view of how do you defend open market?
Right.
How do you defend a free international market? How do you defend open markets? Well, clearly, if you open your markets, you are allowing for more specialization.
Right.
I used to use the example of the United States market versus and Sri Lanka. One a little smaller market, another big market.
Right.
Suppose Sri Lanka all of a sudden had protected its markets and not allowed any foreign trade.
Sure.
All of a sudden it opens up. It becomes all the specialization of the United States and Sri Lanka. It wouldn't help the United States much, but it would be a tremendous boon to Sri Lanka.
Right.
So the argument for opening markets is essentially based on the
increasing
returns.
One other distinctive feature of your work is the subjectivism. I guess, well, we said earlier, you know, the Cost and Choice book, which is perhaps your most, sort of extended articulation of a subjectivist position, grew out of the public debt book in a way. But that's an aspect of your work that I've always been a bit puzzled about. I mean, is that something that was heavily influenced by Hayek and Mises?
That I came through independently, although I was influenced a lot by going back and rereading Hayek, who reinforced my view.
Right.
More Hayek than Mises. Mises right. was not so strong a subjectivist as, right. as Hayek. And
right.
Hayek's subjectivism is very important. But actually, I was influenced on that in the public debt book. I talked about the burden of debt.
Right.
And about how it was passed on to future generations. Well, that had to be individuals bearing the burden of paying for the expenditure that was made.
Right.
Individual taxpayers. So that was the burden. That was the cost. Well, I didn't really realize in bringing that down to the individual level, I had to get away from the sort of standard model of thinking in terms of quantitative aggregates. It had to be subjective utility flows.
Right.
And then reacting to the criticisms of that book, and particularly in talking a lot with Jack Wiseman. Jack
right.
Wiseman was
right.
very influential on my in my thinking on this.
Right.
I came to the view that more and more that really the only entities that matter for choices are utility flows,
right.
pluses and minuses.
Right.
And that led me back into the subjectivist literature. Now, I was, in fact, sympathetic to that because Frank Knight himself sort of verged over into that.
Right.
He had a review of Vic Steed's book
right.
in which he almost bought into that.
Right.
Vic Steed was a kind of a subjective analyst.
Yes.
But he never quite got away from the standard equilibrium models, and neither have I.
Right.
And one reason that I've been able to go forward a little bit and still be a subjectivist is I haven't bought fully into it.
Right.
Jack Wiseman and George Shackle, for
yes.
example,
yes, very good
they were frustrated.
Yes.
They just
yes.
sort of became, and, yes. and Lockman even more. They
right.
just sort of threw up their hands. Once you're
yes.
a full-fledged subjectivist, you can't say anything. And so I've been able to sort of say something and yet at the same time be completely sympathetic to their view.
Right.
And what I did in that little book on cost and choice was just take a very simple opportunity cost notion. What does it really mean? And what are some of the implications?
And it's an important book, too, I think, because, well, for example, so much of this marginal cost pricing stuff and so on is coming back mm-hmm. now with mm-hmm. deregulated industries, mm-hmm. electricity mm-hmm. and so on. And the subjectivist element is, not too conspicuous there, I guess.
Well, Steve Littlechild is another example of one who's been able to marry both these.
Yes.
He's like me in a sense.
Yes.
He's a very strong subjectivist. He and Jack were going to write this book together on subjectivism, and then, lo and behold, Steve becomes the whole czar of the whole electricity
right.
industry in Britain as it deregulates. For a decade,
right.
he was the electricity czar overruling
right.
deregulation.
Right.
And so he had to talk objectively about rates.
Absolutely.
And this sort of thing. But yet he did it very successfully.
Yes.
Very successfully.
In explaining ideas, there's an internal and external dimension, I suppose. Mm. You know, a lot of what you've said about your own research program reflects the internal dimension, influences from particular scholars, reading Vixell, serendipitous or not. But of course there are also some external influences, and I want to pick up one example, I think this is an example of this in your own work, which is the stuff on anarchy.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seemed to me that the work that you did in the 70s, leading up to The Limits of mm-hmm. Liberty, work with Winston Bush, and the work with mm-hmm. Nikos Devlatogla,
mm-hmm.
Their book mm-hmm. Academia mm-hmm. and Anarchy, all sprung in a way from the experience of moving to UCLA, mm-hmm. California mm-hmm. in the late mm-hmm. 60s mm-hmm. and so on. I'd like you to talk a bit, if you wouldn't mind, about that experience. And mm-hmm. then whether and to what extent it influenced you.
No, that was very important. The 1960s were very important to me, and they were traumatic to me because, you see, the calculus of consent and my work up to that time basically was written in a kind of a what we might call a hopeful, optimistic, rose-colored picture of the processes of democracy, constitutional democracy. And we wrote the calculus of consent really sort of thinking that all we were doing was sort of taking James Madison's in-court ideas and putting them into modern terminology, modern welfare economics terms, and spelling it out, sort of justifying, legitimizing, in a certain sense, the American structure. And then the 1960s happened.
Right.
And not only within the academy, where it was overt, but elsewhere. And it seemed to me that a lot of these institutions of order that I had sort of taken for granted were stable turned out to be very fragile.
Right.
It seemed to me that the whole set of rules and institutions were breaking down in a big, big way. And so I changed dramatically my outlook. My outlook turned from being extremely, not extremely, but sort of basically optimistic to one which I was very pessimistic. And I didn't see an outcome of the 60s. I thought things were going to get worse rather than better.
Right.
And the wave of assassinations, the purchase of the presidency, the whole, the Vietnam War, all those things seemed to me that everything was breaking down.
Right.
And what to do? Well, I went to California. It turned out to be a mistake. I went there because they had a very good Department of Economics, right, and didn't leave because of the Department of Economics. They stayed very good. But the reaction of the faculty and the administration in particular at UCLA to some of the events in the late 60s just horrified me. I felt like everybody's crazy except thee and me, you know,
right,
the old Quaker saying. And I wanted to get back to somewhere else. And so I went back to VPI in the Virginia Mountains because as a retreat,
right,
kind of. And I had no idea that we could develop anything there. It
right.
was just to get away from the chaos, which I saw breaking down all about me.
Sure.
So we went back to VPI, and Charlie Goetz had the idea of getting Gordon Tullock to come back. He'd already come back,
right,
got me back there, had the idea of setting up the Center of Public Choice. We had a sympathetic administration. We had a very tough administration on the dissidents,
right,
on the students, the rioters, who really cracked down on them. It was an orderly place,
right,
and we got a good physical location, and so we just blossomed out.
Right.
And as a center there, and Public Choice Center sort of has started having visitors from all over the world to come there. And you came,
and
others came. And then early on, before you came, we got a young man out of Washington University, St. Louis, a real Georgia redneck. His name was Winston Bush. And he got interested in anarchy. And, of course, that fit in with directly with what I experienced. The
right.
world seemed to be anarchistic. And
right.
Devlatoglu and I had written this book about academia in anarchy, which is the academies are breaking down.
Right.
And so Bush was interested in the formal properties of anarchy. So he was a mathematical economist, and so he was developing that. And he organized a seminar. We had a very exciting two or three years, early 70s, in which we were really examining what would happen if the world did fall down totally
right.
in anarchy and how you could analyze it and this sort of thing. So out of that came several books, including My Limits to Liberty, Tullock's Social Dilemma,
right.
two little books that were the volumes of the seminars. And so that was a very exciting period. And then turned out in the 70s, things turned around. They weren't nearly as bad as I had predicted.
Right.
Universities survived, after all.
Right.
That was an exciting turn. The 60s and how it happened and how it affected me in terms of my work is a part of my story, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. In that connection, and perhaps it's worth mentioning, about 1970, before, say, when I got back to Virginia from California, I felt like that I needed to write a testament or whatever.
Right.
I needed to write the Buchanan version of Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom, or Hayek's Constitution of Liberty. I was ready to write that book.
Right.
And so I actually started. I tried my best to write such a book. And I actually wrote an introductory chapter, had an outline or two, and so forth and so on. And I found like I couldn't write it. Mm. There was too much Frank Knight in me. I wasn't willing to be quite so specific as Friedman or Hayek could be about this is what they ought to do.
Right.
I mean, I was not willing to go that right. far in a normative sense.
Right.
Too much yes, this, you
yes.
know. This.
Right.
And so it was a failure. And I was floundering, really floundering. And that's when Winston Bush came along right. and started concentrating on this formal analysis of anarchy. And that right. provided me the lock-in to write The Limits of Liberty, which is not like those books at all.
No.
In other words, it's sort of a substitute for right. that book that I didn't write, so
right. Jim, as a Southerner, federalism must be kind of in your blood. But how important do you think a federal structure is for liberty? And how important, too, I want to ask, is the right to secede?
Mm-hmm. Well, I, as you know, the federalism as a sort of a research program has been a part of my general research program throughout my career. As a matter of fact, my dissertation was on yeah. fiscal federalism, and I worked in that general area. You and I have worked on it together.
Sure.
And I do think that the notion, especially if you have a large polity, that the federalism is an absolute requisite for maintaining any sort of liberty, any sort of check on the power of central government has to be effective power and at the level of the subordinate governments. This sort of divided sovereignty between the central government and the separate subordinate governments. And ultimately, in some ultimate sense, I think the right to secede has to be a part of the structure, otherwise you don't really have that authority. I think in the American context, the founders surely had in mind that the separate states would have the right to secede. Of course, Lincoln fought a war to prevent that, and effectively after that, we have not had a genuine federal structure in the United States, despite the fact that we call it that. I think the more modern application of the federalist idea, or federalism idea, has been the European Community,
right.
and for at least a decade or more, I argued that Europe had a genuine constitutional opportunity to move into really an effective federalism where they would, in fact, have guaranteed integration of markets, free movement of goods, capital, and resources, labor across national lines. And yet, at the same time, the separate nation states could maintain their existence and could compete one with another in terms of regulation and so forth and so on, with an implicit right to secede. Unfortunately, it seemed to me that the way Europe developed, that idea was not dominant. It seemed to me it was offset by two other ideas that are at the opposite extremes. One, the sort of residue of socialist ideas of directing and regulating everything from Brussels,
right.
which seems to have become the dominant view.
Right.
The other is the more or less the Margaret Thatcher view that no nation state gives up one whit of sovereignty to a
right.
central authority, whereas the by far the best option would have been somewhere in between those two.
One important aspect of the way in which federalism contributes to liberty is the capacity of people to move mm-hmm. when coercion becomes
yeah.
too great.
Yeah. Yeah.
There is, of course, an important other way in which that can happen, a way in which America has figured over its history, and that is by being a place where people can go when coerced
yeah.
in their own domestic
yeah.
countries,
yeah.
and
yeah.
so
yeah.
floods of immigration yeah. into America. A testimony to
mm-hmm.
a kind
mm-hmm.
of provision of liberty, and that's been
mm-hmm.
something in America from
yeah.
the outset. That suggests that, as it were, open borders,
mm-hmm.
Even without
as it were, federal political structure, open borders between nation states,
yeah.
is an important element in minimising coercion. And I wonder whether you see America, for example, as locating itself properly in that respect. I mean, in particular, along the Mexican border. I mean, what's your view on how open the borders should be?
That is a critical question, as to what extent you can have open borders. This gets in directly into immigration type
right,
of policy. And America, as you say, has been a haven for people oppressed who felt they were oppressed, who could move from, take the exit option and move yeah. from countries where they thought they were their liberties were at stake. But then you've got such a disparity in the economic development. You've got economic reasons quite apart from freedom reasons, from sure. liberty reasons for migration. I think you can make an argument out from an economic point of view, from a classical liberal point of view, for allowing open borders and free immigration, provided you did not have a superimposed welfare state.
Exactly.
But once you've got a superimposed welfare state in which people who can enter can immediately make claims against the taxpaying part of the population, then that changes the whole dynamic of the immigration policy.
One of the mysterious elements, at least to me, in your intellectual apparatus is this phrase, the relatively absolute absolute.
Yeah.
Partly because it seems to play a particularly dexterous role whenever mm-hmm. the arguments mm-hmm. get tough, you know. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you'd try to explain to me, again, what the concept of the relatively absolute absolute is designed to capture.
Well, as I've told you and as I've told many people, I couldn't live without the relatively absolute absolute.
Wow.
It gets me out of a lot of jams. As you say, it gets me off a lot of hooks, too. But it's a concept or a notion and a phrase that I picked up directly from Frank Knight and Henry Simons, mm-hmm. both my professors at the University of Chicago, who use this term. And I think it is very helpful in the sense that it prevents the necessity of taking a position either as a relativist in all respects
right.
or as an absolutist.
Right.
I am neither. I'm
right.
neither a relativist nor an absolutist. It's right. an in-between position. You don't take, for example, take ordinary morals, for example.
Right.
I don't have to become an absolutist like Alan Bloom implied in The Closing of the American Mind and say ultimately there are absolute values out there and we just have to search for them. But I certainly don't have to take the view that everything is up for grabs, everything is relative.
Right.
You take the view that there are some moral values that have been in existence a long time, that have been proved the test of history, that you can make an argument for, that it is best to live our ordinary lives by treating those as relatively absolute absolutes. Now, what you mean by that is they're relative in the sense that they're not beyond examination.
Right.
Nothing is sacrosanct. At one level of existence, you can evaluate those. You can say, well, are they really stable or unchallengeable right. as they might seem? We can challenge them in the academy. That's the job of the academy, is to do that. To challenge these basic values. But at the same time, that's not going out and saying just anything goes at
right.
all. So
right.
it gets you off that terrible problem of becoming one or the other.
Well, there is your current research, not
yeah,
the relatively
yeah,
absolute
yeah.
absolutes, but the using the metaphor of the commons as a lens mm-hmm. in which to understand political processes. Perhaps you could tell us something about what that commons metaphor means
mm-hmm.
and then what, as you see it, the implications of this way of thinking about politics.
Well, first of all, let me say this. I think that one thing that's been very helpful to me is Nietzsche's aphorism. Nietzsche is great for these aphorisms, and he talks about looking at the world through different windows.
Yes.
And I use that many, many occasions. Yes. It's useful, and it gets back to this relatively absolute in a way. It's useful because it suggests that you can look at the world through different perspectives, and therefore you get different interpretations by looking at it through different perspectives.
Right.
But on the other hand, there is a world. In other
sure.
words, there is a world you're looking at.
Right.
So you're looking at a room through different windows, so
right.
to speak. Now, this use of the commons metaphor applied to politics is simply looking at politics through a different window. And therefore, it's partially explanatory, I think. It seems to me that the standard conventional work, orthodox work in public choice, our work, our joint work, and work I've done with others, as well as orthodox political science, has always started out looking at politics as a collective enterprise in which collective decisions are made. But they're made by a decision structure that is, in a sense, monolithic.
Right.
In other words, take majority governance.
Sure.
You have a majority coalition or a median voter or whatever.
Sure.
Once you make a decision, you make a decision. And that's a monolithic structure of decision. Whereas the commons metaphor suggests that maybe a good part of politics is that, but there are other aspects of politics where there is not a single decision maker.
Right.
Where you have differing decision authorities making decisions simultaneously.
Right.
And politics is that, a political result emerges from the action of those several authorities.
Right.
And that's where the metaphor of the commons comes in. The commons goes back to the medieval notion
right.
of where the peasants are all allowed to put their sheep on a common pasture.
Right.
Obviously, as each of them decides separately,
right.
Independently, to put his sheep on the pasture, he will put his sheep on there as long as he can do better than on the open range. As a result, you get the value of the pasture dissipated. And that has been picked up. It's standard in economics. It's a century-old discussion in economics. But it's only been picked up the last 40 years or so. It applies to the environment, applies to water, air resources, and everything else. But looking at the government that way, you see, you come to the view that, look, political outcomes are not necessarily the outcome as determined by a single decision-making
right.
group or coalition.
Right.
You can have differing coalitions making decisions that all of which produce political outcomes.
Right.
A good example, for example, suppose you had a rule or a setting in which any majority can tap the general tax base.
Right.
After all, the potential
okay.
productive capacity of the economy is the tax base.
Yep.
And so you have a rule or a setting in which any majority can, in fact, tap that tax base. So then you have an ideal sort of model of a commons thing where you have differing coalitions deciding on imposing a general tax to finance education, to finance highways, to finance this and that. Out of that emerges an outcome. But that outcome is not due to one majority deciding multidimensionally what is going to be the total budget. And rather, it's this group, this group, this group, out of which emerges an outcome. And that's a rather different conceptual way
right.
to look at
right.
the whole political process. Than the normal way, and I do think it is explanatory for a good part of what we talk about as politics.
I wanted to ask you some questions about your career generally now, and one aspect of that career, which is kind of notable for a person of your distinction, is the fact that a very large proportion of your time has been spent in universities that are outside the United States
yeah,
academic
yeah.
establishment.
Yeah.
Several questions about that then. I mean, that must clearly have been some sort of choice that you made. I mean, why did you choose to operate in the boondocks? And do you think it had any effect on the sort of things you did or the sorts of things you're able to do.
Well, I think it is a very important aspect of my career. I'm not sure that your implication that I had the choice is quite so strong as before. I suppose at certain stages I certainly could have gone to one of the more established institutions, especially as I developed my career developed, but I chose not to do that. And both in the education earlier on, going through a little Middle Tennessee State Teachers College and then the University of Tennessee, then Chicago. Chicago is the only really good university by standards of excellence that people would generally apply that I have been associated with. And so I think it has had an effect on me in the following sense. I think it it has allowed me to work somewhat more independently, to develop my own ideas more rather than in a cocoon of people who were so dominant that they would in fact have made it difficult for me to be as independent.
Right.
To give you an example of that, I did have the opportunity to go back on the faculty of the University of Chicago a few years after I left there. And I'm very glad I didn't.
Yeah.
Had I gone back there, I would have felt like I was dominated by the extreme intellectual abilities and capacities of colleagues, that I would have felt much more inhibited about going out in my own directions.
Right.
So I think I've had a good deal more liberty in intellectual pursuits by being sort of a big frog in little ponds,
right,
to use Robert Frank's terms,
right,
rather than a little frog in a big pond.
Right.
I've learned the hard way that really my best performance as well as my contribution,
right,
is higher if I go to places that are in the boondocks.
Right.
I use the example of Chico State as a university as an example, which I visited. I go back as a Nobel Prize winner and speak at those places, and I stay a few days, and I meet a lot of faculty and a lot of students. And my line that I give them is, I come from a place just like this.
Right.
And if I can get a Nobel Prize, you can get a Nobel Prize.
Right.
And yet it's amazing how that exhilarates the,
yes,
students and the faculty.
Yes.
All of a sudden, they begin to see a different, right, possible future.
Right. Right.
In other words, I can,
right,
tell them I'm one of you, and they accept that, whereas,
right,
that doesn't matter in these other places.
We've talked a little bit about winning the Nobel Prize, mm-hmm, and about what it meant to you in terms of busyness, mm-hmm, and so on. But more generally, it must have been an enormous affirmation to you.
Well, it was, in, you say affirmation, it was kind of vindication,
right,
in a sense,
right,
of fact that what I'd been working on was worth something to somebody,
right.
And as I've said elsewhere, and as other people have said, it is a tremendous event, and the Swedes do know how to put on a show.
Yeah.
And that week, Nobel Week in Sweden, is a fantastic week, and no one can quite experience anything like it unless you've actually been through it. And of course, it elevates you to a different status in the,
yeah,
eyes of many people. And go back to what we said earlier about me being an outsider. The outsider comes inside.
Absolutely.
Almost by necessity.
Do you think things like the Nobel Prize are a good idea? I mean, as an institution, that's what one might put it. Do you think it's good that we have such things?
Well, I think that prizes generally are good, and we don't quite have enough of them,
right,
in the academy. As Gordon Tullock, you know, has always argued that, and I think I agree with Gordon on that.
Right.
I think you can make an argument that the Nobel Prize in economics was not a good thing, in the sense that it was set up with the implication somehow that economics is a science,
right,
analogous,
right,
to the natural sciences. And it's not, as Hayek pointed out in his Nobel Prize speech,
right,
not at all. On the other hand, I think having put economics in the list, that's been very good for economics to have it in there. I think the profession itself has shaped up a lot because of the, yes, of the Nobel Prize.
I mean, you often say that you're not interested in saving the world.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. When I say I have very little interest in saving the world, I'm really picking up from Frank Knight again, who said that one of the delusions of modern liberals is that somehow they feel obligated to feel they should contribute toward making the world a better place. By their standards.
Sure.
It seems to me that is a delusion, that they're likely to frustrate themselves that way. And it seems to me that what Knight was saying, and I share, and was influenced a great deal by him in that respect, is that what we're doing is engaging, in a way, in a kind of an ongoing dialogue, an ongoing constitutional convention in which everybody's involved, so to speak. In which we're trying to discuss schemes and ways in which we can make the world better, but not as better by what I would like to see better, but rather out of a generalized discussion, something will emerge that will make the world better. That's a totally different way of looking at it, I think.
You once remarked to me, perhaps more than once, that if you don't some days imagine you're a fraud,
yeah,
then you're sort of lacking in imagination.
Yeah.
This is a kind of comment about, perhaps this goes back to relatively absolutes in a way, but the significance of the academic enterprise and one's own work and so on, an issue perhaps of not taking it too seriously, but then on the other hand having to take it seriously.
Yeah. Well, we have a man that both of us knew, he's dead now, Bob Staff, he continually worried. He was an economist, had a PhD in economics, did economics faculty, but he continually worried about the fact that the only productive thing he thought he'd ever done was when he worked in his father's bicycle shop. He simply couldn't justify his own existence as an academic economist or any other academic.
Right.
You sort of, it's difficult to justify it. You can't see a product. You can't get your hands on something you're producing. You're producing students, maybe, and so forth and so on. But really, what can you really say? You publish something, but what impact does it have? Is it not that somehow society is just funding us and we're lucky and we're getting our rents and being happy about it, and why worry about it? And most of us don't even think about that. But if you force yourself to think, you wonder sometimes. The payoff to academic scholarship generally is long term.
Yeah.
It's very long term. And you got it. It's very tricky as you move into economics or philosophy and those kind of things, much more difficult than the sciences. The hard sciences, ultimately, maybe the spirit of science, and you're furthering, somebody's going to make a new discovery, find out more, some medical, some discovery or some physical discovery. But it's hard to know with us, because we have to kind of reinvent the world and propose things and work on them and hope they have some impact.
I remember you saying to me on one occasion that if you'd been born in the UK, you'd have been a socialist.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that? I mean, what was at stake in that judgment?
Well, I do think that there's even today, even at the turn of the century, there's a very substantial difference among countries and among cultures in terms of what we could call social mobility. And I do think that still today in Britain there's much more class-oriented society. I think it's much more difficult to for someone in the lower classes, to working classes, to move upward. Upward mobility is less. I think that's true all over Europe. Mm-hmm. And I think we're affected by our history. I think the Americans' history is important in the sense that it's been more open, especially open to upward mobility. And I think that's one reason you have not had the sort of socialist movements in the United States nearly to the extent that you've had in Europe. I also think it's true in terms of the history that has to do with religion. Now, a good friend of mine, Professor Francesco Forti in Italy, has been a socialist all his life, leader in the Socialist Party before the Socialist Party broke up. He says that in America he'd be a libertarian, free market-oriented person, and I think he's right. Traditionally, the socialist and the party grew up there in part in opposition to the Catholic Church, the dominance of the Church. And so, again, it's history. And I think that history makes a difference. And I think growing up as a working class or lower middle class person in the British situation, I would have necessarily oriented myself toward the interest of that group. So there are differences.
But what that suggests to me is that there are forms of coercion, to go back to your original claim about your antipathy to governments and support for free markets and so on. There are forms of coercion that don't lie in the power of the state directly.
I think I would agree if I understand what you're getting at. There are means through social structures and others in which you can essentially have discriminatory treatment. And yet, in one sense, the market can be open.
Yes.
In Britain, for example, 50 years ago, you would have been allowed to apply for any job, but no working class boy with a Yorkshire accent could have got to that job.
Right.
He'd been an Oxbridge boy if he'd, you know, to get the job. And those are kind of things now, admittedly, in a kind of a, if you look at a discrimination, look at this from a discrimination point of view, admittedly, those who choose to exercise that discrimination are in fact paying for it. But people will pay for it sometimes.
Sure.
People don't maximize net wealth in the pure sense.
No. Well, that brings me to a story about the United States, actually, which I want you to tell. This is the story about your experience in the war.
Well, I've told this story about my own personal subject to discrimination against me because I was basically a Southerner. When I went in midshipman school, my draft number came up very early, and I went into officer's training in the Navy, and we went to New York for officers' training school, and turned out that just so happened about 600 of us in our group, in our class, and it turned so happened that most of us were from the South and the West.
Right.
There were very few from the Eastern Upper Ivy League groups.
Right.
But we had to form up into companies and platoons quite early on before we took any tests or anything else like that. And so they had to appoint midshipman officers for the companies and the platoons.
Right.
And we were organized in terms of alphabets,
right,
purely alphabetical. So the A's and B's were my group. But it turned out we didn't have any Yale's or Harvard or Princeton people at all in our group. So who were you going to appoint as cadet or midshipman officers? Well, down in the R's and the S's and the T's, they had too many. So what they did was they took Bill Rockefeller, who was the cousin of Nelson's, and imported him over into our group to become our platoon leader.
Right.
And you can imagine how that went down with us.
Right.
It turned out 12 out of the 18 cadet midshipman officers were from the Ivy League establishment universities, whereas the percentage in the group would have been less than 10%. So that was sort of overt discrimination.
Right.
And you can imagine what that did to my communist leanings at that time.
I can.
Yeah.
And I mean, some of that residue has stayed with you, don't you think? I mean, you've had a very mistrustful attitude towards the rich, which is unusual among libertarians,
mm-hmm,
not so much self-made men or women,
mm-hmm,
but much more second-generation,
mm-hmm,
wealthy families. So, for example, I know you can usually be energized, yeah, let's put it, yeah, by the Kennedys.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, why is this because it's the second generation in particular that you see as being the creation of class systems?
Well, I will respond to that, but let me first go back to my other point about the Navy experience.
Right.
I can now understand, now I'm sophisticated enough to understand statistical discrimination.
Right.
And I'm sure that it was perfectly rational for the Navy to pick out, right, and put as midshipman officers the Ivy League boys, because on the average they probably did better than we did. So I understand it, but right, I still didn't make it seem fair to me.
Right. Right.
Now, to go back to your basic question about my position on inherited wealth and on the rich in general, I do think there's a major distinction to be made between the rich who make it on their own and those who pass it along.
Right.
And I've always been sort of congenitally in opposition to the gross inequality of opportunity that is provided by inherited wealth. It seems to me, to the extent possible, if we're going to genuinely try to achieve a free society and a society in which people are free, it does seem to me that we ought to try as best we can to take whatever steps are necessary to generate equality of opportunity. And I realize, full well realize, that you can never get there.
Right.
I full well realize that if you don't allow inherited wealth, you would get, people would invest more in their education and training and culture. There are going to be inequalities and opportunities. No way you're going to eliminate it. But on the other hand, steps that you can take toward providing equality of opportunity, it seems to me, always is a good thing, in the sense that it makes for a more society in which people have a sense that they're in a fair game.
Yeah.
To me, the important criterion is, are you in a fair game? And to me, it's not a fair game if you start, or a fair race, if you start somebody out with 30 feet ahead of the other person.
Right.
The starting point, starting gate. Right. And sometimes you even play by differing rules. See me, you play. A fair game has to consist of playing by the same rules, and to the extent possible, you start from the same position. Now, if roughly you do that, then you allow people to go as far ahead as they can. I have absolutely no objection whatsoever to Bill Gates having everything,
right,
that he can make.
Right.
Now, I do recognize, of course, the incentive effects. I recognize, yeah, that if you disallow people from picking out and doing what they want to with their money, they're not going to earn as much money, they're not going to invest it as well, and so forth. So it's not, and I realize you're impinging on those persons' freedom when you coerce them into doing it in certain ways rather than others. And so it's not the man who is giving the money away that I want to coerce, it's the man who's getting it.
Right.
Nobody has a right to it. No, right. Kennedy has a right to get $10 million when he gets whatever of age,
right,
as compared to the others, or, no matter what the old man might have earned.
Right.
So I've always been very much in favor of trying to adjust to some extent on that score.
You are, though, a bit drawn to the French existentialist position, mm-hmm, or at least, mm-hmm, the idea. You occasionally, mm-hmm, say that, well, the whole game's absurd.
Mm-hmm.
And I take that's a reference not just to academic, mm-hmm, games, but, mm-hmm, to the, yeah, life, yeah, enterprise totally taken. Is that your view? I mean, that at an ultimate level, the whole thing's,
well, let me,
kind of absurd?
Before I get to that, I will get to that.
Good.
But let me go back to religion a little bit. I am a tremendous admirer of the Mormons.
I know this. Yes.
If I were to choose a religion and could jump into a religion,
right,
and really be a believer, I would no doubt where I'd go. I'd,
right,
be a Mormon tomorrow.
Right.
Because I think the way they have organized and used their religion as a means of organizing their lives, I spent a 5-week stint at Brigham Young and saw them operate and went to their homes and so forth.
Right.
I have a tremendous admiration,
right,
for what they're able to do.
Right.
And so I want to put in a plug for the
Mormons. The Mormons is good. Okay.
Now to go back to your existentialism question. I was influenced a lot by, and think about it a lot, by Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus, which is a wonderful book, I think. Where he is what he's doing there is saying, look, let's try to organize our lives in such a way that even though it goes back to the relative absolute,
surely.
At one level, we sort of recognize it's all absurd. At another level, we got to keep the game interesting. We got to keep it such that it's worth playing.
Right.
We don't give up in despair.
Right.
So he was able to sort of satisfy himself, and sort of that's what I've tried to do in a certain sense. You want to make the game that you're in interesting. You want to recognize, and the way you make it interesting is you set up your own counters, and you sort of move toward achieving a bit here and there, make it an interesting game, use the game analogy if you want to. At another level, if you really force yourself back and really get into examining these deeper issues, these deeper questions, the whole thing may be absurd. What is it all about?
Right.
I mean, to me, that's a fairly satisfactory position. Now, a lot of people jump off cliffs because they can't solve that problem.
Sure.
Well, I've been thinking more and more about that. Now, this is something we have not talked about. Why is it that I am interested in what's going to happen when I'm no longer around?
Right.
Now, in my case, it can't be genetic. I don't have any children, so it can't be genetic, which is popular now to call it genetic. It can't be that. But yet I'm intensely interested in that.
Right.
Now, why is it I'm interested in it? Well, and why was Mr. Goodrich, for example, so interested in carrying forward liberty, and so forth and so on? Well, it seems to me that, and this does get me a bit away from the methodological individualism point, a lot of stuff that's inherent in my position.
Right.
It does seem to me that we, or at least I, feel like I'm a kind of a member of a kind of a tribe.
Right.
What we might call a tribe that is a continuing tribe. It doesn't die. It doesn't have. It may die, but it doesn't. It does beyond my mortality.
Right.
It's a kind of a tribe that would be called, described by the spirit of liberty or the spirit of classical liberalism.
Right.
And it seems to me as a participant in that game, in that kind of furthering those ideas, and I live as long as those ideas live, in a way. I'm just a part of a stream, and in a sense that stream's going on.
Right.
Now, it takes people to keep pushing and keep motivating that stream, or else the stream could die. It's not necessarily immortal.
Sure.
But on the other hand, it transcends human life in an ordinary way. And yet it provides meaning to ordinary lives. It seems to me the spirit of liberalism, the spirit of classical liberalism, or the spirit of liberty, if you want to put that, can be a kind of a justification that sort of gets you away from this ultimate absurdity, in a way.
Right.
In a way. So maybe I've moved away from that.
Right.
And I've just been thinking about that fairly recently, because I remember Betty Tillman had organized a luncheon meeting in honor of my 60th birthday, some 21 years ago. And I talked a little bit about this, but I think I've articulated more fully now as to what I'm really thinking about. And I think it's worth thinking about a little bit.